Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I'm your host, Ryan Stackhouse. And today, we're going to be talking to Christian Ingrau about his new book, Believe and Destroy, Intellectuals in the SS War Machine. Christian, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Well, before we start off on the book today, I was hoping you could maybe tell us a bit about it yourself.
So I'm a French historian. I was born in the middle of France the beginning of 70. I attend my MA in Clermont-Ferrand and in Paris, and then I wrote a PhD in Amiens. But in the meantime, I lived 2 years in Germany to be able to read the archives for my PhD thesis.
How did you come to write Believe and Destroy?
That was Believe and Destroy is my PhD thesis, and at the time I was trying to find an object on which I could reach on the meantime. What the people believed and thought and what they were doing, the discourses and the practices. Yeah. And I was looking for a group of people who were able to be a good vantage point of it all. The Reich Security Main Office, this institution that was gathering and melting the Gestapo and the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS, the security service of the SS, was the ideal vantage point, because all these people were formulating a Nazi ideology between 1933 and 1939. And then, after the outbreak of war, they were able to put the discourse into practice and led these groups of security that were of central interest in the face of invasions of Europe.
You talk about the war as a sort of defining experience for the generation of the men who went in the SS. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
The idea of the book and of my thesis was to write a kind of a history of the experience in German, Erfahrungsgeschichte, a history of the experience of quite a generation of people who were born between 1900 and 1910 in Germany. And this generation of people who is called the generation of the youth of the war, Kriegsjugend Generation, that was people who were not able to fight on the front, but who lived and experienced the war as kids. And this particular experience was, had a central interest to understand what was the Nazism, what was National Socialism, and what was the internalization of National Socialist belief. The problem for the historian is to find the sources in which we can reach the childhood of these people. And it's really, really difficult. The only source we can rely on is this biography all these people have had to write when they entered the SS, when they were a candidate to enter in the Black Order, and these documents were Lebenslauf, that's a kind of life narrative of curriculum vitae or resume. And in these these sources. These people tried to describe what was their childhood, but that is never the center of interest of this document. So we have to rely on a really thin kind of information. What we can say is that the entire German society had very special experience of war, because on one hand, that was a paradoxal one. On one hand, the German waged the war really deep into French territory. They were apparently the aggressor. On the second hand, the Allied, the Entente, organized a blockade that had a deep impact on the German society. And after 1916, the economic conditions in Germany worsened. That was not a question of starvation, but that was a question of having health problems, sanitary issues, etc. All the people had the impression that the Entente, okay, the French and Great Britain, had the intention not perhaps to only try to win the war, but also to reduce as much as possible the German population. The war that had been waged at this time was, in the German perspective, a war against the civilians, the women and the children, because that was a blind war. One of the most critical issue I want to raise in this book is that at some point, the German society and the children I'm talking about internalized an apocalyptic anxiety, an eschatological anguish that was one of the most critical issues in the German society after the war. The idea of it all was that issue, what was at stake in the war, was not only political or geopolitical matters, but the enemy was waging a war against Germany, and a Weltfeind, a world of enemy, was waging a war which aim was not only to fix a problem, but to reduce as much as possible the German essence and the German existence. So the point is that the German had the feeling that all our existence was at stake at this moment. And in every country, there was a sort of mass communication from the society in direction to childhood. And in Germany, this message and this apocalyptical anguish was expressed to the children, and they internalized the thing.
The school years come across as very important as this generation that grew up in the war was coming of age, really. What happened in university that was so important?
The transition between school and university is really important, because that was the years in which Germany lost the war, and the way out of war was really specific in Germany, because when the French stopped the war, there is an armistice, peace tractations, etc., and all the people come back from the front, go into the regiment houses, and put down the weapons, and get back their civilian clothes, and get back to societies. In Germany, that's not the case. In Germany, when the war ends, the regiments come back in the society, but with all their light weapons. That means that 5 million of guns, machine guns, pistols, hand grenades, knives, etc., just invade German society. All these people come back with all their weapons. That's widespread, the violence that was till now concentrated on the front, is widespreading in the society. The difference between the year before the war and the year after the war is the following. When you take a group of students, a group of conservative students and a group of social democrat students that meeting in the street of of a German town. Before the war, they are just fighting with fists. After the war, these students, when you think about such an episode, the students are veterans of the First World War, and they have guns with them, and they don't fight with fists. They fight with knives. They fight with guns. They fight with machine guns, and that's what the U.S. historians call the brutalization of the society. The society gets used to brutality and to violence, and the resolution of the social conflicts is more armed than ever. So that's exactly what happens to the academic world in the immediate after war. During this period, the students were mobilized by two really big issues. The first one was the civil trouble that took place in the east on the German-Polish border, in the Baltic states, in the north on the Danish-German border, with the communist revolution in Berlin, but also in Thuringe, in the Ruhr, and the independentist troubles in Rhenania, in Rhineland. So the global overview of this trouble seems to confirm the fact that there was a world of enemy waging war against Germany, that during this lapse between 1918 and 1924, the students were led to experience a nationalization, but that was really really radical. They became radical because every item of the social mobilization during the wartime was reaffirmed by after the war. During 4 years, all these people, all these children, had heard that this war had the destiny of Germandom at stake. And what happened after the Versailles Peace Treaty? After the peace treaty, the threats didn't vanish in the eyes of the German students. There was a threat everywhere. There was the communist threat within the German society. There was a threat outside the German society with the Polish uprising in 1990. There was the threat of the communists in the Baltic state. There was a threat, the Danish threat, in the north, in the Schleswig-Holstein. There was the French and the Belgian threat with the invasion of the Ruhr and the Rhineland. So the really anguishing war culture that had been widespread during the war seemed to be true and seemed to be justified by the fact. So we can watch a process of radicalization of the German student movement in Germany. All these people who were children between 1914 and 1918, who were becoming teenagers and then students, had experienced radicalization. This radicalization can be shown by the dynamic of the evolution of the student movement. Between 1919 and 1921, we can watch in almost every German university the Völkisch movement, the ethno-nationalistic movement, win the elections. Association whose main objective was to pull the Jewish elements outside the university. That's a sign of the nationalization of the German student, because you had on one hand a core of radical people who were militant, who were fighting for the success of these ethno-nationalistic positions. But in the meantime, you had elections in which 80% of the student population were participating, and these ethno-nationalistic students won the election at more than two-thirds of the votes every election. That means that already in these years between 1919 and 1924, the anti-Semitic belief and racial nationalism was spread in more than the half of the students. And we can ask the question of the fate of the Weimar Republic when you know that these young elites were already ready to eliminate it and to replace this republic with an authoritarian regime already in 1919 or 1924.
One of the things I really like about this book is how you show the connection between student activism and scholarship. What was that connection for the SS generation?
The university at this time, the German university at this time, is a really complex world in which you can articulate and bind a really scientific way and the formation and a really political militancy. You can, in the meantime, work hard on a PhD or on a Magisterarbeit, a master thesis, and in the meantime, be one of the most leading elements of the Nationalsozialistische Studentenbund, of the League of National Socialist Students. And there is no contradiction between both, because in faculty like the geographical one or the historical one, you can articulate and develop in the same step what you are thinking of the German-Polish border, and do in the same time a history of medieval history of the German settlements in this region. German scholars in the 90s and the years after have shown that there was a kind of they say that was a science of legitimation that was developing itself, and in which German scholars were acting like SS officers and in the meantime as historians or geographers or sociologists. And there was a kind of political commitment that was through studies and through a career in the SS or in the SD, etc., etc. There was a parallel between academic career and the militant career. And there was not a problem to act like a Nazi when you were in the university, and to act like an historian when you were in the security office of the SS.
Yeah, from this youth generation or war youth generation of activists, you get the SS security service, and then, as you say, that goes on to become the Reich Security main office. How do ideas of struggle and control that you talk about shape that development?
The question is to study the activity of all these people, of these young students who were children during the First World War and radicalized themselves in the years after the war. What was their main tasks and activities in the Sicherheitsdienst, in the security office of the SD? And the first task was to develop the ideology and the way to deal with problems as Nazi. They tried to conceive national socialist policies in the economic area, in the social area, and the racial area, and what they called the Lebensgebiet, the vital area. The Lebensgebiet was a word to denominate every area of the life of a population, a racial population. So That was a word that was, the Lebensgebiet was a word to legitimate the fact that the SS officers of the Sicherheitsdienst felt to have the legitimation to give an advice in every area of the life of a society. They were able to give an advice or to conceal on the industry of shoes or of leather or of weapons or on the racial legislation, etc. They could intervene in everywhere, and they tried that. It was their duty to deepen Nazi ideology and practice in every area of the society and life of the society. So that was the task of the SD Inland, this security service of the interior of the Germany. And on the second hand, there was a second service in the security service that was a classical intelligence service. So the historians, the jurists, the economists, the philosophers, the linguists that were involved in the security service were working on all these issues after the National Socialist seizure of power between 1933 to till 1939.
Yeah, the beginning of the war in 1939 really seems to open up a world of possibility for these men. How did the SS intellectuals think about the East?
The question of the outbreak of war is a really interesting question, because when we get into the archives and the documentation these people left behind them, we can see that the war that's rising in 39 is a war of revenge. They think the war against Poland exactly with the same mental tools that they did for the war in the summer 1914.
It fits into this same narrative of a continuation of the First World War.
Exactly, exactly. These people have the feeling that they are waging the war again at the exact point as they left it in 1918. Let me just give an example. All these people we are talking about are involved in the practice of the fourth wave of invasion in Poland. The first wave, Blitzkrieg, Guerre éclair, lightning war. The first wave is aircraft which are bombing. The second one is an armored wave of invasion with tanks, which breaks the defense system of the enemy. The third wave of invasion is motorized infantry, the people who move with vehicles but who are fighting at foot. But the Nazi have a fourth wave. And the fourth wave is elements of the police and the security service, motorized as well, and whose task is to take the control of the territories, towns, and the buildings of the political power of every town they are sizing. This group are called Einsatzgruppen. These groups of interventions existed already in Austria, in the Sudets, Sudetenland?
In Western Czechoslovakia.
Okay, Western Czechoslovakia, thank you. And the rest of the Czech Republic that was invaded in 1939. Okay, but this fourth wave is a wave of security. It's almost nothing to do with war. We see that when with a practice in Austria or in the Czech Republic, because all these people were carrying out task of police. In Poland, the thing will change radically. the Anzac Open in Poland will kill in 6 weeks 12,000 people. And when you see in the documentation the way they are legitimating the killing of these 12,000 people, you see that there is two main legitimation. The first one is that the Einsatzgruppen mentioning the existence of Franc-tireur, Freischärler.
Oh, partisans.
Yeah, but I don't want to use the word partisan because there is difference between the Franc-tireur and partisan in the Nazi mentality. The sources are mentioning not partisan, but Franc-tireur, Freischärler, sharpshooters, okay, something like that. These sharpshooters were people who had survived the three first wave of invasion, aircrafts, tanks and infantry, and who were taken prisoners by the Einsatzgruppen. And the SS officers of the Einsatzgruppen told these people, okay, you didn't give up with the first, second, and third wave of invasion. You were still fighting when we came. So you are this kind of partisan. We have the right to shoot you. And they did it. This rhetoric and this practice was not entirely new in 1939. During the invasion of North France and Belgium, in the summer 1914, the German Imperial Army used to eliminate thousands of civilians and of people with the accusation of being franc-tireurs or sharpshooters. So what I'm trying to say here is that this war against Poland was really a war that was waging with the same tools than the First World War. The people who we are dealing with were children that internalized all these rhetorics during the Weimar Republic, because the controversial question of the existence of this Freischärler was a central issue in the discussion on the German responsibility in the outbreak of the First World War. So all these people during their childhood, had internalized all this rhetoric, and they were just mobilizing them again when they had to legitimate in front of their crew and their people the fact that they had to kill again. But you know that this revenge dimension of the war was not limited to the campaign against Poland. When you think about the campaigns against France, you'll see that the armistice, the stop of the hostility that was signed in June 1940, was signed exactly in the same railway wagon that was used in 1918. The only document that the SS commandos were looking for in the French archives in Paris and in all these location in which they were hidden was the Treaty, the Versailles Treaty. So there is a vindication dimension in the war that were waging the German that was really important. They had the feeling that they had to end the First World War that had not been ended in 1918.
So continuation of war into the East, there's also an opportunity for them to create something new, right?
Yeah. Yeah. This war against Poland, this war is a giant phase. Because there is a phase that's turned into the past. It's a war of vengeance. It's a war of that's here to end finally the one which broke out in 1914, but in the meantime, the conquest of the Polish territory is opening a new era for the German leadership. In the week after the invasion, Hitler announces that he wants to reorganize the ethnic relationships within Europe. That's his own words. And he delegates the task of the of this reorganization to Himmler. Himmler will create a whole bunch of institutions whose task will be to prepare this new German era after the war. In Mein Kampf, Hitler had formulated a project of racial and social renewal of the German society, of the Nordic society. And with the invasion of Poland, the Nazi hierarchy had the feeling that the time work has come to make the utopia come true. They create this race security main office, whose task will be to ensure the security and to enforce racial law and decisions into the whole European society. On the second hand, the National Socialist hierarchy will create an agency whose name is Reichskommissar für die Festigung deutscher Volkstum. That means the Imperial Commissariat for Strengthening of German Dome. That's one of the most interesting institutions because it gathers the energy of already existing institutions. The first one is the Office of the Race of the Settlement, Rusha, which is an agency whose task is to implement racial expertise. So the people who are involved in this institution are physicians who have a racial background, a raciologist background. They studied with Hans Günther and all these scientific of the races who are active in Jena or in Berlin, etc., etc. So they can submit people to racial expertise and assess them on a scale from the high above in which you are able to become an SS, so a member of the racial elite of the Third Reich, to the bottom in which you are a Jewish people and you don't have the right of a decent existence in the Third Reich. So this Reichskommissariat of Strengthening German Dome, RKDF, mobilized this agency to implement huge social engineering operation, not in all the territories that were invaded by the German, but in these territories that were that had to be incorporated in the German Reich. In these territories, the German policies was really simple. They had to expel people who were non-willed, that they didn't want, that they rashly didn't want, so Polish people, Jewish people, etc. And in the meantime, Hitler had a really rational policy, diplomacy policy, to negotiate with all the countries in Eastern Europe the repatriation of people that were called the Volksdeutsche, the ethnic Germans, and that were meant to become the pawns of the Germanization policy. They were seen as people of German culture and German language and German race, and they had to be resettled in this occupied territory, in this incorporated territory, to Germanize them. So that was the policy the Nazi implemented in these incorporated territories. But the most important part of Poland was not this territory. That were territories with Warsaw, Krakow, Lublin, Radom, etc. What we call the Congress Poland, the Poland of the Congress. These territories were not, couldn't be Germanized in the following years in the eyes of the German leadership. So a so-called general government was built for this territory. That was a colony. the name of the general government was taken from the French Gouvernement Général in Algeria. So that was really a colonial entity, which was given to Hans Frank, a jurist, one of the most close collaborator of Hitler. This territory was a kind of trash territory for the SS, and they used this territory to unsettled Slav people, Polish people, and Jewish people from this incorporated territory around Posen or Łódź. They deport these people in the regions around Varsovie and Łódź and Lublin. The people we are talking about, these 80 doctors and philosophers and historians and jurists who conceived this policy and implemented them, had the feeling that they were beginning to make the utopia come true. They were deeply convinced that the dynamic that was taking place here was a dynamic that could realize the Tausendjähriges Reich, the millennial empire. And they were so more convinced of this thing when began the preparation of the invasion of USSR. Because in this time, the planification of the Germanization of Europe was not only the one of Poland, but the one of the entire Eastern Europe. The invasion of USSR is, in this perspective, a real challenge for all these people. First, it is an economical and logistical challenge, and everybody is aware of it. The German leadership and the leadership of Wehrmacht take a really important decision in February and March 1941 that no food will come from Germany to this army of invasion. That means that the 5 million of people of this army will have to feed themselves on the territory that they are invading. The consequence of it is that, I quote the archive, that 10 million of people have to starve. 10 million Menschen sollen verhungern. Dozens of billions of people have to starve to death to let the army to feed them, to feed itself. So the point is that we have another scale in the German violence here. Not only mass shooting, not only reprisal, not only anti-Semitic law and progression, but this time, for the first time, I think, rational decision to eliminate more than 8 to 10 million of people in USSR. The Nazi plan is to let the Soviet cities of the Eastern USSR starve, to surround them and to avoid that people can break out and to avoid that food can go in the cities. So that the entire urban population of this eastern fraction of the USSR would be decimated. We have to think about it because we know that during the Tsaristic Empire, the anti-Semitic legislation allowed only to Jewish people to live in all these towns of the western part of USSR. So when the German take this decision to decimate the urban population of the western part of USSR, they are condemning practically to death the German communities in USSR. The people we are dealing with are aware of this dynamic and they will carry out the organization of the Einsatzgruppen in USSR. We know that the one in Poland killed 12,000 people in 6 weeks, but there is another push in the statistic of the Einsatzgruppen in USSR. They don't exist for 6 weeks, but for 6 months. They don't kill 12,000 people, they kill 550,000 people between the 22 of June 41 and the 31 of December, the 31st of December 1941. So the question is to try to understand first the role played by the SS intellectuals in this dynamic, in this genocidal dynamic, and second, how evaluate the practice of the Einsatzgruppe. And I think that we can first assess that there was a turning point in August 41 in which the Einsatzgruppen do not kill only Jewish men, but will begin to kill women and even more children. At this time, we go out from a violence that was conceived by the Nazi, the SS officers that were leading the Einsatzgruppen as a violence that aimed to neutralize the danger of insecurity in the back of the fighting troops, to a violence that aimed to the total annihilation of a community. What is interesting is that in this chapter of the book, we can try to follow really precisely the way these people, these intellectuals of the SS, were mobilized to convince the people where they were leading to involve themselves in the murder of children and women. That's the murder of children and women is never an evidence, never something which is easy or normal, etc. Even for the worst and the most cruel Nazi, that's always a problem, an issue. And that's not really a surprise. The people who were leading all these groups who will carry out this transgressive task, that is the genocide of women and children, were people who had studied history, philosophy, literature, etc. Because all these people were the only one who had the rhetorical know-how to convince the people that the murder of women and children was a sine qua non task if the member of the Einsatzgruppe wanted to work toward the invention of the Tausendjähriges Reich.
So I think this is hands down one of the best parts of the book, is the way that you deal with the psyche of the SS intellectuals during this process. How did members of the SS experience that violence?
They experienced the violence as an unavoidable but transgressive task. They were, on one hand, absolutely convinced that they had nothing to do but to kill all these people, that it was an historical task and an avoidable one if they wanted to see the advancement of the millennial empire. But in the meantime, they were also convinced that killing women and children was the most horrible task they will face in their entire life. So there was an articulation between the horrific situation in which they believed to be and the Notstand, the situation of emergency, and the fact that all these things, all this horror were unavoidable and they had to get through them to be able to give a future to their children and the rest of the society. That was the articulation that was the the most important structure of it. They had two ways to legitimate the genocide. The first one was, it's me or him. It's us or them. And the genocide and the policy to kill men, women, and children was legitimized, for example, by the carpet bombing that were taking place in Germany. The leaders of the Einsatzgruppen were mentioning this bombing to convince their crew that they were waging war against Jews, but the Jews were waging war against us through the Barber Command, through the Royal Air Force or the USAF, etc., etc. So the racial determinism was a way to interpret the war that was establishing an equality between the Jewish people who were dying in front of the pit in Ukraine, in front of the Nazi machine guns, and the German women and children that were burning in the bombs, under the bombs, the Britannic, the English and American bombs in Germany. So that was only allowed by the social, by the racial determinism, that was the core of Nazi belief. And the only people who were really able to do this atrocious parallel were these SS intellectuals, and they managed that what they had to do in the sense that no member of the Einsatzgruppen were refused to do what they had to do. No member of the Einsatzgruppen to put in question what the group had to do.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the last part of the book where you were going through this process of how really they're processing almost on an individual level all the different ways they were justifying it to themselves.
After they stay in Russia and in USSR, all these people had really different destinies. There was a group of them that could not stand the horrific experience that was the genocide, and they ended in alcoholism, depression, etc. So that's a really tiny group. But all these people could not stand this atrocious experience. Most of the people we are dealing with were people who were not volunteer, who did not volunteer for these tasks, and after a stay between 12 to 18 months in USSR, they went back in Berlin, and they had shown that they had the strength to commit themselves to the most atrocious consequences of the National Socialist policies, and they were people on which the Third Reich could rely on. So they had a promotion, and they became the head of the Reich Security Main Office agency for people or they became the head of the Gestapo or the SDA for France or Italy, etc., etc. So most of the people we are dealing with promoted after the genocide. And there was a third group of people that were so excellent in the genocidal tasks and in the mass murder that they became specialists of it. So when the Third Reich collapsed, these three groups will face the Allied inquiries. Most of them won't be sized by the Allied. A group of 22 or 23 Einsatzgruppen leaders have been judged in Nuremberg. Most of them were sentenced to death. But the evolution of the geopolitical situation between 1945 and 1952 led the American institutions to make that all these death sentence were commuted in life sentence and then to time sentence, and all these people were released really soon in the 50s. Some of these people were gifted enough to avoid the condemnation and the sentence, and were released in the 60s. One of the most high rank general, SS general, Otto Ohlendorf, chose to face his fate and chose to deal with his own guiltiness in the face of the American tribunal in Nuremberg. And that was a suicidal choice he made. And he assumed the thing, and he had been executed in 1942, I think. So the first group of people were the group of people who was facing guiltiness, and that's a group of two or three people, and they said, okay, I did it. We did the genocide, and we did the genocide for this and this and this reasons. And this choice that consists in standing through the guiltiness and the responsibility is a really rare one. I already met him in two cases. The second one, which is a choice of flight from guiltiness, is to say, okay, I was I acted upon orders, or I didn't know that it was what was asked to me, or I was not exactly involved in the way you are describing, etc. was the most used strategy of defense of the people of these SS intellectuals, and it worked most of the time, because after the American trials, the German institution tried to prosecute all these things and set up a legal framework that was really a hard one. Namely, the German prosecutor could only prosecute these crimes with the laws, the criminal laws of 1937, the one that was in charge and in force during the facts. So to be able to indict someone, you had to have the name of the criminal, the name of the victim, a date, and a location. And that was almost impossible for a location like Babi Yar with 371 victims, and to articulate one of these 3,300 victims with Paul Blobel or Kuno Kalsen or any one of these SS intellectuals was impossible as a legal issue. So even if the German institution made a real impressive effort to put all these people into trial, all these inquiries were not followed by trials, and all the people we are dealing with were though prosecuted, but most of them were not tried.
Well, Christian, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we draw everything to a close, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I released a book for some months on the National Socialist Utopia. The problem of this of the time between the invasion of Poland and in the summer 43, in which the SS officer we are dealing with did internalize the belief that the time had come to build and to realize the millennial Reich. And this book on Germanization and the realization of utopia is one of my most important projects at the time. But I intend also to begin inquiry on the relationship between national socialism and work, and all the dimension of work, with the work status, work representation, ergonomy, work, wealth estate, and national socialism, etc., etc. That's one of the projects I will involve myself in the following years.
Well, hopefully we'll see that in English translation as well.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, that does it for us here at New Books in German Studies. Once again, we've been talking to Christian Engrau about his new book, Believe and Destroy, Intellectuals in the SS War Machine. It's available from Polity Books, published in 2013. And if you think you might be interested in picking up a copy, consider using the link in the blog post. It'll help Christian out, and it'll help us out here at the New Books Network. I'd like to thank you for joining us, and hope to see you next time. Until then.